Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the 343 Podcast, where we work tirelessly to elevate the level of discourse and practitionership here in American soccer. Today is Masterclass session number 5. We have done 4 previous Masterclass sessions. They are the 4 previous episodes to this one. So if you want to check those out, I would highly recommend them. But today we are talking about what is quote unquote elite. This word elite is tossed out. It's become a running joke, if I'm being frank, as to what is an elite soccer player. It ranges anywhere from decades ago, calling players like Landon Donovan elite, or calling Dempsey world class, or Altidore world class, or elite. And it's kind of funny, you know, and sometimes it's not so funny because it really derails us from having good conversations, intelligent conversations about football. And it's gotten even worse here at the youth level in the past, I'd say 10 years, 15 years, where everybody now thinks they're elite. We've got leagues that call themselves elite. We've got clubs that call themselves elite. And we've got folks running around saying, oh, look at this 12, 13-year-old kid. He's truly elite. Guys, let us calibrate ourselves a little bit better. And that is what this episode is all about. So tune in. Many gold nuggets per usual here. Benny joins me as he always does with these masterclass sessions. Parents, if you want to dive a little bit deeper and learn better how to guide your kid here in the American soccer landscape, you can go to 343masterclass.com. And coaches, as always, we started over 10 years ago with a coaching education program that has transformed the landscape here in the United States, with thousands of coaches going through the program, hundreds of them who took it very seriously, transforming their coaching careers and their players' careers, obviously, by proxy. You can go to 343coaching.com, where we've got free and premium programs for you there. And if you happen to be coaching the 7v7 format with the little ones, you can go to 7v7coaching.com. All right. Let's learn a little bit more about what this term, quote unquote, elite means. Here we go.
All right, Gary, well, let's get into the show.
Go for it.
Elite soccer characteristics. This is the lesson that we're covering today. I think the word elite gets thrown around too easily, especially in American media, right? You often see them labeling some MLS players as elite players, or maybe players that really are shocking, and they're still getting defined as elite. So how do you define elite in a global soccer context?
Yeah, so hard. Well, the first thing that comes to mind when you said elite, I just thought of ECNL, right? What does ECNL stand for?
Elite Clubs National League.
Got it. Yeah, so there's part of the problem already is parents, like, oh, where does a kid play? My kid plays in the elite league. What are you talking about? Yeah, ECNL, that's the elite league in the country. So anyway, to answer your question, what do I consider elite? The cream of the crop, the very, very, very top of the player pool is elite for me. So even if you're playing in the top leagues in the country, whatever those happen to be, whether it's ECNL or MLS Next or whatever alphabet soup league you're talking about, that doesn't make you elite at all. Maybe the top 10 players in each of those leagues, I might consider taking a look at and thinking this is an elite player, maybe. So what does that bring us to? Maybe brings us to 20 or 30 guys nationally that I might say, let me take a look a little bit closer and see if they're elite. Why is that? Well, because compared to their American counterparts, sure, and top flight in the country, sure, you might be on youth national teams at that point. Sure, you're getting invited to ID camps. That's another thing. Everybody gets invited to ID camps and everybody gets happy about it. Okay, cool, be happy. That's all great, but it doesn't say much because in the broader continental or global context, you don't exist. Truly. And even if you're on U.S. youth national teams, whether it's the U15 national team, U17 World Cup, U20 World Cup, and the rest of the world, they might be looking at the American team and they might consider one player there, maybe of that whole entire group. So that has already shrunk our pool down, Benny, to one player in the whole country as being considered maybe elite. If you look at Yamin Lamal, who's playing for FC Barcelona, a starter and starter for the Spanish national team, he's still a teenager and he's considered to be one of the greatest in the world. Now, you don't have to be like that guy to be considered elite at all, okay? But just to give people a little bit of a reference as to what players around the world at age 16, 17 are already accomplishing. And even if you get the incredibly slim chance, slim opportunity that they want to elevate you here in the United States to maybe make your MLS debut at age 16 or 17, that means nothing. I mean, congratulations to the kid. Okay, obviously. Congratulations to the family, everybody involved. Awesome. Nobody knows who you are. Okay, no, you haven't accomplished anything. So anyway, I'll stop there because I know we can dive a little bit deeper into what does it mean from a technical perspective, a tactical perspective, and all those sorts of things as well.
So yeah, I mean, for me, what comes to mind is, okay, let's say a D1, there's a D1 college soccer player, and they may be referred to in their local hometown as elite. But what you're saying is that in the global context, I mean, these guys are far off the level of what the highest standard is out there in the world, right?
Sure. Well, even in your case, Benny, where you're talking about a Division I soccer player who's very good, maybe makes first team All-American as a freshman or something like that. If you put him in the context, if you throw him in with youth national team players, U18 national team players or something like that, he might be shockingly terrible, like really bad at that point.
What are some of the like non-negotiable technical attributes of what you would consider a world-class elite player? I mean, I say world-class. Is there a difference between world-class and elite?
A whole other level, Ben. World-class. So people now are saying, oh, Christian Pulisic is world-class. Look, relax, people, okay? He's having a phenomenal season with AC Milan. Exceptional. He's a starter. He's killing it in the Champions League as well. But we always lose perspective in this country because you don't consider how many other players are also like Christian around the world. How many other Champions League players are there who are starters on their clubs and doing exceptionally well in the Champions League and exceptionally well in their domestic league? There's a ton of players, Benny, a ton of players. So we need to pump the brakes on talking about world class. But yeah, the world class is above elite. It's the elite of the elite at that point. From a technique perspective, God, Ben, I don't know. It's hard to dissect it here in a podcast in audio. You really have to take a look at video and dissect it from a video perspective and also from a positional perspective as well. Because if I put a center back to play central midfield, you know, he's fucking terrible technically, just excruciatingly bad. If you put a center back as a center mid, or even if you put a center forward and a classic number nine as center mid, pretty bad stuff. It's not going to be great. It's not going to be elegant. So it's a position dependent too, Ben, when we talk about technique.
Something that you mentioned in the masterclass lesson is, right, when you're watching a player, you can really notice, like, for example, when you look at Andres Iniesta when he was playing at his peak, the ball's coming to him. And the phrase that you use is that he caresses the ball, meaning like the ball is almost an extension of his body. He's just so comfortable and gifted on the ball. So can you expand a little bit on what you mean by that, caressing the ball? Because I think that's a big telltale sign is their first touch, right? Is their first touch 5 yards away from them, or is it, you know, there's glue on their shoe and it's just literally boom, right on their foot and no problem?
Yeah. So I'm going to throw out a bunch of words that people are going to interpret in different ways, but I'm going to do my best. I'll start with you saying their first touch, if it's like 5 feet away from them, obviously that's a telltale sign that they have a terrible first touch. If they receive a pass and, you know, the ball doesn't bounce off their foot 5 feet away, but instead gets killed there right in front of them where they want it, that's better. But that also does not tell you that they have a good first touch. And so we get to that next level, which you kind of described, which is you accomplish that first touch, that you kill the ball right in front of you or kill it exactly where you want it to be, but in a smooth, fluid fashion. Okay. It's not robotic. And the thing that comes to mind, an analogy or metaphor, is if you remember when you first started driving, Benny, whether it was automatic or stick shift, a stick shift is the best example, but most people don't do stick. So I'll just do automatic. When you first start to drive, your acceleration and decelerations are not smooth. You kind of like hit the gas and you're like, oh shit. And you really pumped it. And you're like, oh man, I didn't mean to like pump it that hard. And then you let go of it. There's this jerk that occurs, okay, back and forth. And it's not a smooth acceleration to a cruising speed. And then it's not a smooth deceleration to a full stop either, because then you hit the brake and you're like, oh, I hit it too hard or I hit it too light. And you're pedaling the brake, you're pumping the brake, and you're, you know, getting whiplash, basically. And so you accomplish the goal of stopping at the red light and then moving when it's green, just as the smooth person does it, but it's a very different sort of experience and a different sort of control that you have of the vehicle. So I don't know if that helps better define what we mean by having technique that is smooth and fluid and the biomechanics all make sense and the ball looks like an extension of your body, just like the car is an extension of you as well, versus it being some sort of foreign object.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, Gary. A clip that comes to mind to me, I'm sure you've seen it, is Busquets in training and they're doing like a rondo or little possession drill, but it's super tight space. And these fools are smashing the balls into his foot. But like you said, it's just so fluid the way that he controls the ball. Another big thing that you can easily tell whether or not the player is elite is whether or not they're able to keep the ball for their team, right? And something that goes into that is their distribution, meaning short and long passes. So how important is it for a player to be, one, to be able to keep possession of the ball for their team, but two, the quality of their passes? How do you define what is an elite player?
It's fucking hard, man. It's hard in a podcast, but I'm going to do my best, all right? You need all kinds of ranges, short, medium, long. You need all kinds of strokes in your arsenal. What do I mean by stroke? Inside of the foot, outside of the foot. Lamine Yamal does outside of the foot like nobody's business. This is all the rage now. Things are going viral because he slaps the ball with the outside three. It's called three fingers, right? There's that, there's hitting it with the laces. So there's backspin, there's curling it. There's all these different sorts of strokes for all three ranges, short, medium, and long. And then one really good defining characteristic is if you're able to do those short, medium, and long sort of passes accurately to the correct foot of your opponent in one touch after you receive a bullet from your teammate. So let's say you're receiving a cannon of a pass from one of your teammates and you are able in one touch to execute a short, medium, long range pass on the money to your buddy. And then the second factor is consistency. Yeah, parents are going to be sending me video clips now of their kid doing that, but show me the kid doing it consistently throughout one single game or two single games. Don't cherry pick some moments from, you have a library of 100 games and the kid did it twice in 100 games, and then you're sending that to me. Like, it means nothing. So consistency is the other thing, Ben.
And this is the hard part, Gary, especially to the untrained eye, meaning somebody that hasn't watched soccer their whole life. For those of us that have watched it, I think we can, not easily, but we're able to tell more which players have those qualities. But something that you mentioned in the lesson is that everything that we just described is not a measurable quantity. But can you expand on that a little bit?
Well, I'm going to put in the context here of folks in the States, we love our stats. We love our statistics. I used to collect baseball cards. I used to know quite a bit about baseball. And, you know, you go around with the kids in the neighborhood and you quiz each other and, you know, they'll whip out a card and it's Dennis Eckersley, you know, a baseball pitcher from the A's. And I would spout out the ERA, you know, just all the numbers in the back of the card. We love our stats, Ben. And MLS and the dominant culture here in the United States, the monoculture, is comprised of folks who principally come from those other sports. And they're bringing around their statistics-loving baggage with them to soccer. And so they love to say, oh, look, it's proven. This guy has this many goals, this many assists, and this pass completion. He is the best player in the league or the best player on the team. And look, it helps, but compared to the other sports, a bunch of nonsense. Okay, so the things that we just talked about, the quality of the pass, the quality of the first touch, that cannot be placed on the back of any sort of soccer player card. You can't capture it. You can't capture whether the player made the right decision to pass it to their center forward or to pass it to the winger. You can't capture it. All that's captured is, was the pass completed or not? And in what sector of the field it was. There's other things that you can measure for sure, but you can't capture decision-making necessarily. And even worse, you can't capture a first touch quality or passing quality.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing, Gary, because I think a lot of players maybe get overlooked, especially you mentioned stats in the US, right? Coaches or fans or even parents, they only look at the stat sheet. And think about it, if you're like a holding mid, a six, it's not like you're going to be getting goals every single game. So oftentimes those players get overlooked. And so does that mean that they're not elite? Absolutely not. I mean, those players make a huge impact on the game, whether or not they show up on the stat sheet.
And they, well, Ben, to give them credit, but they are aware of that and they do know it. But in theory, yes, they're always going to fall back on the numbers and the statistics and the pedigree. So another stat is, where does this player play? What league? You know, is he a starter? Is he not a starter? Has he been called to national team ID camps? Has he been called to a national team camp? Has he gone to an actual international tournament with the national team? What club does he play for? You know, all these sorts of things are quote unquote stats, but fall under the pedigree sort of bucket. So even though folks, parents specifically, might understand everything that you just said in theory that, hey, all this stuff doesn't capture it, at the end of the day, that's what they rely on anyway. They don't sit there and say, yeah, you know what? All the stats are wrong. Or not wrong, but all the stats don't matter. The pedigree doesn't matter. This player is better than all those other guys. Like, they don't do that. Who sticks their neck out and does that? Doesn't happen, man.
Let's talk a little bit, Gary, about finishing. Because, okay, you may see a player on a team that has scored 30 goals in one season. Does scoring 30 goals make him elite? Or do you more consider the way that he scored those goals? Meaning his technique and his finishing. Is he able to slot it every single time into the upper right corner? Does scoring 30 goals make you an elite player?
Yeah, but Ben, you already cited the answer. You have to look at the quality of the goals. What do we mean by the quality of the goals? Well, firstly, I think it's important to have seen a shit ton of football, because what that enables you to do, in my opinion, is it enables you to put yourself in the brain of the player who's going to shoot and kind of understand the thought process of the person who's going to shoot. Did the person actually mean to take this sort of touch and actually slide it bottom right corner? Did the shooter just shoot it on target and hope for the best? Those are like two sort of extremes, and it happens a lot. And most of the time, everything I've seen here in youth soccer in the States, most of the time, the players playing in the top leagues, on the top teams, and including the youth national teams, most of the time, they're just shooting on target. That's it. It doesn't matter. They're not picking out a spot and saying, I'm going here and executing. They're saying, oh man, I have a little window of opportunity. I'm just shooting on target. And then it might get slotted top left corner and it's a banger. Everybody's saying a world-class goal. What a banger, whatever. Great goal. Awesome. Goal is a goal. But you know what a world-class goal is or an elite goal is? If the guy meant to put it top left corner. That's the difference.
A goal that comes to mind, I mean, I don't know if you would define Gio Reyna as an elite player, but his goal for Borussia Dortmund, the ones where he receives it across his body, little body feint, slots it like upper curler into the right upper corner. You know which goal I'm talking about?
No, that's brilliant. He meant to do that. And right. If I'm not mistaken, that was his first goal in official competition for Borussia Dortmund. You should look that one up, man. Put it in the show for sure.
Banger. And you know that he meant to do that. It wasn't just like you just described. It wasn't just like, oh, I'm going to fucking launch it to goal and let's see what happens. You can see him clearly, you know, pick out a spot, hit the right technique, and he put it right where he wants.
100%, Ben, 100%. And the same one with Alex Mendes against Porto. He did the same thing, right? Yeah. Took it 25 yards out. Took a touch, picked a spot, and then curled it.
Over Pepe,
for sure. But again, the second ingredient is consistency, right, Ben? Consistency. So Alex did it once. Gio did it once. Maybe Gio did it another time. I don't remember all his goals, for sure. But consistency is key.
We talked a lot about the technical ability, right? But what do you think about the tactical ability, meaning like soccer IQ? How important is that in defining a player's eliteness?
Just as important, Benny. And it's position dependent, like I said before. So that's why it's very difficult sometimes here with audio. You have to really show video, which is what we do, obviously, in the master class. But every position has different tactical requirements. And what we mean by tactical does not mean what many Americans here, unfortunately, think of. It doesn't mean a formation, doesn't mean 4-3-3, 4-2-3-1, 3-4-3, no, none of that stuff, 4-4-2, no, that doesn't mean tactical. Tactical means the set of decisions that you're basically instructed to do in different circumstances that the game presents to you. So the left back is going to be presented a different set of circumstances than the center mid, and so their tactical capabilities have to adjust accordingly. So I don't know, an example, Benny, let's say that you're the left back and you're playing against the Spanish national team. Okay. Well, guess what? Don't fucking be bombing forward on overlap runs every possession, because you're going to get punished. You're going to get slaughtered. Probably the tactical thing to do here and the capability that you need is know how to bunker and counter. Yes. So I don't know. That's not a really good example, actually. Maybe we just need to go down the rabbit hole of decision-making, period. And it's, again, I'm struggling here because it's position dependent and we really have to show it, Benny. I don't know. Maybe you can give me a hand.
Well, some of the fundamental decisions that we mentioned in the course is the obvious ones, right? When to pass, when to dribble, when to go forward, when to go back, when to switch. A big one that gets overlooked a lot, when to pause, when to have a quick restart, defensive positioning, and off the ball movement. Those are just a few that we mentioned.
I love them all, man. Yeah. I don't know what to add to that, dude. That is the key. I guess now it's a matter of how to develop that and who does it better than who else. And I don't know, if I'm watching a game, a youth game, if a player consistently makes the wrong decision, and I do believe that there is such a thing as a wrong decision. For instance, if you're the left back, let's stick with the left back here, and you've got two opponents in front of you and your center back is wide open for him to get it and then switch it to the other side of the field where our team is numbers up, and left back instead chooses to dribble into two opponents, that is a shockingly bad decision, which means the player has shockingly bad tactical acumen at that point. And if the player is consistently doing something like that or something very similar, then it's clear as day. This player doesn't know how to play football. The other extreme is if the player is presented with those scenarios and they consistently make the right decision, then you have a little hint, okay, maybe this guy knows a little bit about how to play.
I mentioned the big one, right? When to pause. And I think that's something that gets overlooked a lot in American soccer, you can say. You've mentioned before, I think you had a whole episode about it with Joey, about how soccer in the US is played at one speed, meaning it's just back and forth, back and forth. So maybe for the audience, you can expand a little bit on that phrase, when to pause, right? What does that mean to you?
There's two different interpretations, and both are good. One is what you just said, is trying to manage the rhythm of the game. And like you said, in the US, it's all just one speed, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And there's no breathing to it. So a player with high tactical capability knows when to speed up and when to slow down his own team. And he can do that when he's got the ball at his feet. So if it's time for a counterattack, his first touch is going to be aggressively forward and he's going to move the team forward immediately with urgency. That's a rhythm. And if the counterattack is not on or is not supposed to be on, or maybe you are winning 2-1 and the counterattack is on, but you're winning 2-1 and you don't want to give up the ball, when you get it, your first touch is not aggressively forward like you usually is. You step on the ball and you just chill and relax and have everybody take a breather. And then you gently tap the ball back to your center back. And that communicates to the entire team, hey, we're not going forward, we're relaxing. So managing the tempo is one such interpretation. The other one, which is more subtle and shows a lot of tactical acumen and understanding, is let's say that you're the center mid and you receive the ball in the final third and you see like maybe an outside back coming for an overlapping run with the winger or something like that, okay? Or the winger is a little bit behind and the pass is not on for the attacking mid quite yet. You shouldn't give it to that guy making the run quite yet. You need an extra 3/4 of a second, you know? So the attacking mid will kind of like stutter and give that 3/4 second pause for the runner to get, you know, into position, which is, 5 meters further ahead than where he currently is. And then he executes the pass. But it's that moment in the mind where the attacking mid sees the runner and says, oh, that's the pass to play, but not now. It has to happen in 3/4 of a second from now. That pause right there is killer. It's amazing from a tactical perspective, and it's killer from the perspective of being able to execute the attack versus a failed attack. If he had passed it 3/4 of a second too early, that's a pause.
How do you train that with players, Gary?
Ooh, you can train it in pattern play and verbally communicating as the coach in pattern play. For example, saying, hey, Johnny, relax, let the play develop, you know, and you're exaggerating it at that point because the pause will be like 2 seconds long. And in real live action, you might not have 2 seconds for a play to develop, which means the play actually is not on if you have to wait 2 seconds or 3 seconds. But you can still train it so that they actually understand the concept. And then that coupled with the players watching professional games at the highest level religiously for years, both those things combined, in my opinion, have a chance of the player intuitively assimilating the concept and doing it and it being part of their tool set.
One thing to note, Gary, a player can't be elite forever, right? Father Time always wins. What indicators do you think suggest that a player has kind of plateaued and reached their ceiling at whatever age it may be?
My mind wanders, Ben. There's a whole bunch of avenues we can take. The more obvious one is the age one, because I think the older a player gets, the harder it is for them to incorporate a different way of playing than what they're used to. And that can mean technical capabilities and tactical capabilities. So technical capabilities, you imagine that you've learned how to receive a pass a certain way for 12 years, and then all of a sudden you want to change the way that you receive a pass. Change your biomechanics. Okay, Gary, what does that mean? I don't know. It means the way that you move your body or adjust your body in order to receive the pass, the way that your thigh actually flexes or doesn't flex, or how high you raise your leg when you're going to receive the pass. It's one of those things that can't be quantified, Benny, unless somehow you strapped yourself into, you know, when they capture these images of athletes for sports video games, you know, they'll put a sensor at all the joints and then the athlete runs on a treadmill or does different activities. And so you're capturing the location of all these sensors on the joints of the athlete. So then you can actually capture numbers associated with the biomechanics. Unless you're doing something like that, you can't capture the data, Ben. So it's hard for me to express what I mean by changing the way that you receive a ball or changing the way that you pass a ball. I think, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm not an expert in golf at all, but I seem to remember maybe 10 years ago or maybe even longer at this point, Tiger Woods, it was reported that he had changed his golf swing, but I think it took him an extraordinary length of time, like a year over a year, or maybe it was a multi-year thing. And during that stretch, he didn't win any tournaments. He didn't win any tournaments because he was in the process of completely changing how he golfed. So I don't know if we can look that up or fact check it or put a little clip in here. So that's the age component. Like once you get up there in age, I don't care how much you train or how much you practice. If you're Josh Sargent, you are not going to be Andres Iniesta, okay? Or if you're Weston McKinney is never going to have the technique of Xavi Hernandez, okay? It's just not going to happen. It doesn't matter what you do. And the same thing goes from the tactical perspective, in my opinion, too. If you've been playing football a certain way forever, like here in the States at one speed forever, and don't understand the concept of building out of the back, haven't really trained pattern play, haven't really trained structured defending like the Italians do, it's going to be extremely difficult for you at age 16, 17, 19, 23 years of age to maybe go into one of those environments and be like, oh yeah, I got this. I'll pick this up and it'll just be natural to me. I think I'll just stop there, Ben. From the age perspective, it's very tough to adjust. That's why it's key and critical to get them early and try to give them a lot of these tools.
Well, on the other end, Gary, at what point is it too late? Meaning if I'm 13, 14, or 15 and I don't possess all of these qualities already, like, when is it too late for a player to never become Iniesta or Xavi? Can a player who was shockingly bad from the ages of like 10 to 15, can they ever become world class? Or is it too late at that point in their development?
Fuck, it's so hard to say, Ben. Look, if you're asking me to be a betting man, I'll say it's impossible and I'll put my net worth on, if you bring me a 13-year-old who's never played or 15-year-old who's never played, I'll put my net worth that they don't become a world-class soccer player. Can there be exceptions? Yes. That's why it's hard to answer that, Benny. I don't know. Everybody's kind of like on a curve. And depending on how much work you put up front is how much higher that curve can go at the very end of your trajectory. So if you're starting late, the curve is lower, the peak of the curve is lower than if that same person had started earlier. But look, we're not saying anything new here. Everybody kind of understands this, understands it in theory, in every domain, Ben. If you want to be a great scientist, great mathematician, the earlier you start, the better off you're going to be. If you want to be a great business person or God knows what else, I mean, that's a little bit different in my opinion, because there's no real age limit associated with those sorts of skills or management skills or organizational skills. I think the bar is low in those cases, but the bar is very high for things that require biological manipulation. So in the case of mathematics and science, you're basically solving extremely complex, difficult problems or puzzles, rather. And there's a biological component to that, okay? And you have to acquire you have to wire your neurons a certain way to adapt and be optimized for solving those types of puzzles, okay? And the same thing goes, in my opinion, for sports. You have to wire your neurons in such a way that they are optimized for executing specific biological actions. And so in those sorts of disciplines, the earlier you start, the better off you're going to be. But in other sort of disciplines, maybe like a teaching, maybe like a business, maybe like all these disciplines where you see that the peak performance of a professional happens later in life, maybe in their 40s or 50s or even 60 years of age, where wisdom might come into play, and it's not a biological thing, then it really doesn't, it's not a function of how early you start, man. And you can start late and adapt and be successful, but you can't do that in sports, dude.
So Gary, you mentioned a lot of players today, Lamine Yamal, Messi, Busquets. Do you believe that these players became elite in the team environment, or do you think they can accredit it to the work that they put in individually? We talked about in the last episode, right? Work on the wall, watching soccer games to increase your IQ. Where do you think more of it came from? Was it more so from the team environment and the training that they were getting, or was it the thousands of hours of work that they put in by themselves to become a leader?
Ben, you know the answer. Individually is number one by and far. And then the team environment works to refine you. It's about refinement in the team setting. The team setting is not going to develop your capability to get to the very highest of levels. They can polish the diamond. The issue that we have here in the States, because I don't want people to get it twisted, is that you might have a lot of very skilled, very talented players who do work, do the individual work and become very skilled. But then if their team environment is crap, then there's no polishing of the diamond. And if you don't polish the diamond, then you don't get elevated. And if you don't get elevated, you're never seen. That's one thing where the team actually matters. It is for refinement and it works as your platform, number two. And then the other thing that we shouldn't really talk in this chat, it should be reserved for another lesson, is even if you have everything going for you, if you are not being platformed, you aren't going to go anywhere either. And I've talked about this for over a decade publicly, that if Sergio Busquets or Xavi Hernandez or all these legendary Barcelona players who were technical and tactical magicians, but not physical specimens, if they had been here in the United States with the same technique, with the same tactical, the same footballer, age 12, 13, 15, 17, 19, 22 years of age, they would not have become what they became, because they would not have been elevated here. Coaches here and clubs here and leagues here and the national teams here don't value those sorts of attributes like they do in Spain. And so they would not have been platformed. And if you are not platformed, then you aren't going anywhere.
How do you become platformed here in the States?
You have to get lucky. You have to get lucky and be born in the right area or live in the right state/city, number one. Number two, hopefully have a coach that is very influential and is networked and can elevate you not only on his team, but at the next level and recommend you to national teams, for instance. Then you have to hope that wherever you land, say on a youth national team or at the next level at pro or college or whatever that next level after youth is, you have to hope and pray that the coach there, or the technical staff, or the club, or from the business side, they're like, ooh, we want to elevate and platform this guy. We want to make him visible to the public, and we want to elevate him, and we want to amplify his market value, because business comes into play at that point as well. So you have to have a sequence, a whole sequence of these things going for you in order to get to the top.
This kind of seems like a good place for you to inject some promotion relegation talk, because I think if it was implemented here in the States, it would be much more easier to get platform, right?
Well, yeah, if there was promotion relegation, Benny, then every club across the country would be in a competitive frenzy to identify the type of player that they believe in, that they want, because their survival and their business success relies on it. And so even if you're one of these players, let's say like this hypothetical Sergio Busquets that I claim would never have made it here in the States, say that you were that guy, that kid at age 14, 15, and they're playing but kind of languishing on some team here in ECNL or MLS Next or somewhere not even there. Well, the scouts are out in force with promotion relegation for all the different clubs. And certainly there's a club where maybe my brother, Brian, is the coach, or others who have the same views as Brian are the coaches or the technical directors or whatever. And they are looking for a central midfielder with the qualities of Sergio Busquets. They don't care about big, fast, strong. They just want somebody who never loses the ball, who is super clean technically, who is a tactical genius. He's never going to score a goal in his entire career. He's never going to assist in his entire career. He's rarely going to win headers as a defensive midfielder. He's never going to, you know, run down some guy because he's slow as molasses. But this is the type of six that I want. So in a promotion relegation system, somebody's looking for that player profile. And the probability of finding that guy in some unknown club who's not really being platformed all that much is higher, Benny. It's higher. And the same goes for all the positions. And the same, by the way, goes for the amount of Brian Klibans or folks like him to get to positions of influence also, because clubs want to win. They need to win. They need to win in promotion relegation. So they are also scouting and scouring the land for the top best coaches in the land, the best ones. So folks like Brian would be elevated. And then when they're elevated, guess what? All those sorts of player profiles that we've been talking about have a better chance here in the States than they currently do now.
Do you think with promotion relegation, Gary, more players in the U.S. would have opportunities in Europe, meaning that they're getting more exposure and it's more competitive out here? And European teams would be looking to recruit out here more so than they already are.
Well, with promotion relegation, as opposed to what we have now, the league doesn't own the rights of the players. The individual clubs own the rights of the players. They have the contract with the players. And so every club is able to make their own decision as to whether to transfer a player overseas or not. As it stands now, if we just focus in on MLS, which is the most important thing, it's Division One, the league owns all the contracts. And so even if a club overseas is interested in a player of one of the franchises of MLS, they can't unilaterally say, yeah, we're selling them or moving them up. There's all of these other competing interests or interest period that also have a say in the matter. So does it help? Yeah, it'll help for sure.
So just to expand on that, teams, if they want to sell a player to Europe, they have to get the league's approval. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. The league owns the player. The contract of the player is with the league. It's not with the franchise.
That's insane. Well, hopefully one day this happens. I mean, do you think this will happen in our lifetime, Gary?
I think a lot of unexpected things are going to happen in our lifetime, Benny. A lot. I don't know if you're following MLS now, but they're about to play the final, the Galaxy against New York Red Bulls. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. Look, you're hardcore soccer, Benny. Maybe you knew who the final was, okay? But you don't really care. Do you know what date it is? What time it's happening?
I know it's on Saturday. And I only know, the only reason I know, Gary, is because, you know, the first team that I ever supported was the Galaxy. I remember going to the games as a kid and, you know, being excited and wanting to meet the players. But I could give two fucks if they're in the final. If somebody gave me a ticket, not y'all, go on.
Yeah, it's no big deal. Have you watched any MLS games this year?
Not one, Gary.
at least you're being honest, man. At least you're being honest, dude.
Have you?
Well, yeah, because it's kind of part of the job, but less so than before. And you probably have a subscription because people have subscriptions, but do you have a subscription to be able to watch MLS games?
Well, no. And that's another reason why I don't watch the games here. It's like, if there's a game that's on, I'm like, oh shit, let's see if I can watch it. And then I go to see where it's streaming. No, you have to buy MLS season pass. And actually I take back my comment because I did attend one Galaxy game this season in person. So there you go. I watched one game this year.
Good for you. I bet you didn't pay for those tickets.
No chance.
Yeah, man. So to get back to your question, will things change in our lifetime? Yeah, a lot of things are going to change in our lifetime. And I just went off on this little branch to express why things will change. Because nobody cares, Ben. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. And their business doesn't depend on people actually caring, which is pretty ingenious, actually. The franchise valuations or the league valuation goes up just by default because it's an artificially scarce asset and people want a piece of what's scarce. That's always what goes up in value. And so even if nobody cares, the property is still going to go up in value, you see. But I think the key is competition, and there's a lot of competition for the attention of the public. And I think the next generation, Gen Z, isn't really focused all that much into sports, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong. I think they're a lot more hooked on online things.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that MLS doesn't really cater to the true soccer demographic here, the real diehard soccer fans. It's more an entertainment thing. They want to bring the fans that don't really care about soccer. Right? They're first-time fans. No, obviously, okay, Galaxy's in the final. Stadium's going to be packed. There's going to be quote-unquote fans there repping Galaxy jerseys. But if you were to go to a game in the middle of the season, I mean, it's at like what, 60% capacity, 75% capacity. It's not like they're selling out the stadium every single day. Whereas you go to any second league in Europe and every single game, your stadium is packed with fans that live for the team. You know, that's their whole entire life. So there's a big difference there.
Well, not every country. A lot of countries don't have a lot of attendance at all. But the thing to really think about here, Ben, is that the cities where MLS franchises are at, let's talk LA. Okay. There's a lot of people that live here. Millions of people live here. And there are hundreds of thousands and millions of people here in Southern California who are soccer people. And so just by mere numbers alone, the probability of getting 10, 15, 20,000 folks into a Galaxy game or an LAFC game is by default, it's going to happen by and large, just by sheer numbers alone. It doesn't have to be attractive from a sporting side of the equation. And of those folks that go to the game, most of them are going there just to have a night out with the family, Ben, or just have a night out with their friends, you know, and have some beers and nachos and hot dogs and not be stuck indoors. That's why they're going there. They aren't going there because, oh my God, I live, you know, Galaxy till I die sort of thing. And the folks who do say Galaxy till I die or Portland Timbers till I die, it's not remotely the same as what it's like overseas. It's not real. It's not authentic. They've latched onto something and they've made it kind of part of what they do, part of their identity. But there is no real history there, if that makes sense. There is no real bond like there is overseas because you're not latching yourself onto something that represents a social, political, economic, and cultural stance. It's like, I want to latch onto, what is this? 365 Whole Foods grapefruit sparkling water. You know, maybe if I dive into the history of this thing and study it and really care about it, and I think it tastes great, you know, and I start having online battles with LaCroix, who also does this sparkling water, or Perrier, you know, I have, okay, then I'm going to start feeling things because I'm invested in this team that makes grapefruit sparkling water, but this isn't representing my social, political, economic, and cultural positions, you know, and that's what a true club actually does. And so we don't have true clubs here, Ben. It's a different sort of fan vibe or supporter vibe. It's very different.
You think USL teams aren't true clubs?
I think they're more so than MLS teams because the structure of the business is different in the sense that in USL, the league doesn't own everything. The individual teams are self-owned. They are their own entities. So yes, they are more clubs than MLS teams are, for sure. MLS teams are not clubs at all. There's zero clubbiness with MLS franchises. They are outlets of the league. Everybody who's listening now, they have a kid possibly on a team, in a club. Okay. The club maybe is called whatever, Rush Soccer Club. Okay. And they have, their kid is playing on the U13 team of Rush Soccer Club. So MLS is Rush Soccer Club. And all, imagine that Rush Soccer Club called every one of its teams by a different name, but it's still Rush Soccer Club teams.
So really it's MLS Los Angeles or MLS Dallas.
That's exactly right, man. It's MLS Galaxy. It's MLS LAFC. It's MLS Timbers. It's MLS Dynamo. It's MLS Earthquakes. It's MLS Red Bulls. That's exactly right, man. MLS is the club. If you want to say that you are supporting a club, you're supporting the club that is MLS. That's the club. And you just happen to be living in a region where the club has a team. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches. You can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.